Everybody, Uko, you have helped everybody. That's very great karma. Very good. I will always want to keep these talks just on meditation, nothing else. So that's the heart of what we're doing here. There's so many other talks and so many other subjects, but when it comes to meditation, this is what we're spending our time doing here. And when you focus on this one subject, it really helps the mind get into these deep meditations. But of course, as you all know, that sometimes there's problems come up in the meditation. It's not just as easy as it sounds. It would be easy if you could just do the letting go, but there's something which is very difficult that we just sometimes can't let go. Now, one of the problems with letting go and allowing the mind to be peaceful is when you start meditation, the mindfulness is not strong enough. So basically, you can't see what's really going on. Which means that the beginning of a meditation can be quite hit and miss until the mindfulness gets strong enough to be able to, you know, see the controls of your mind and know exactly what you're doing. And so, you know, you need to be still to get mindfulness, but you need mindfulness to be still. And that is a bit of a problem. So because of that, we do have very many skillful means. And these skillful means keep you still enough so you can really be very mindful. And when you're very mindful, you don't really need those skillful means anymore, because you can see very clearly what's happening, and it becomes very easy to let things be, not to do anything. So some of those skillful means I've already mentioned to you, but today I wanted to put them into a more focused perspective. And I mentioned last night that it was great being able to learn Pali and to start to read the sutras, the teachings of the Buddha in the original language, because from that I got many of my stories and also many of these skillful means, things which, you know, you don't notice in the translation. And I mentioned one of the very early time of this retreat was the two types of meditation. And please don't ever say that's vipassana and samatha. That's not true. I call the two types of meditation second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. The second noble truth, everybody knows, craving or wanting leads to suffering. Third noble truth, letting go of wanting leads to nirvana, leads to peace, leads to freedom, to happiness. Basic teachings. You want, it leads to suffering. You don't want, you let go, it leads to peace and happiness. Very clear teachings of the Buddha, but sometimes people don't apply those teachings to meditation, as if Dharma is one thing and meditation is something else. But no, the two have to go together. And so, straight away, you will diagnose the problem. If you're having a problem in meditation, if you're getting frustrated, if you think it's not working, if you think that, no, just why is every meditation, or most meditations, not good? Every now and again I get a good meditation, but the other meditations aren't good. Diagnose the problem. If you've been wanting, you suffer. If you let go, you're peaceful. As simple as that. So you actually learn from your meditations. If it's not going according to what you want, if you're suffering, if you're frustrated, if you're getting bored, if you're getting tense, diagnose. That's the symptoms. What is the cause? There always must be that you're wanting something. Now, one of the common problems with people meditating here is that many of you have had one or two really nice experiences, and you can't get them back again, and that really sucks. You know, you've done it once, why can't I do it again? So, diagnose. The symptom is you're getting frustrated. It must mean you're wanting something. It is quite clear what you want. You want that experience back again. Even wanting very wonderful, noble things is still wanting and causes you suffering. So that's the cause. What is the solution? Don't want anything. So whenever you are doing any meditation and it's, you're not happy, you're not content, it's not working, it must mean you're wanting something. find out what that is and stop it. But this is how we use insight to take this meditation much deeper. Often that happens to me. I'm meditating, you know, there's a blockage there somewhere, it's not going smoothly, what's happening? And instead of using force, which is what most people do, if it's not working, you just try harder. And that never works, that just makes you more frustrated. Willpower is not the way to get into deep meditation. Wisdom power is. And the wisdom power is you just stop and you investigate. And especially you look at that area, I must be wanting something, what is it? And if you you look at that, you'll always find something you want. When it's that new experience, or you want to sort of have the meditation finished because you're a bit fed up, you want something, you want peace, you want insight, you want something or other. Why do you see that and stop it? The blockage vanishes. And there's a strange thing, there's a common experience that as soon as that happens, you see what the problem is, immediately it disappears. And you go to the next level of stillness. Almost immediately. Once you can see it, it vanishes. You go deep. This is actually what the Buddha meant when, in his teachings. He always used to call this like Mara coming. And when Mara, this so-called bad guy in Buddhism, whenever he would come to try to stop the Buddha becoming enlightened or stop the monks or the nuns from getting into deep meditation, all those monks and nuns would do, traditionally, would say, I know you, Mara. They just see and understand. And at that, according to the tradition, have many times in the time of the Buddha, according to the sutras, Ma would say, the monk knows me, he knows me, and then would slink away defeated. You wouldn't need to punch Ma or kick him in the groin. All you needed to do was say, I know you, Ma, and that was enough to defeat Ma. That's a very beautiful teaching, because any of those obstacles in meditation, you don't need to bash them up or shoot them dead. All you do is, I know you, hindrance. I know you, obstacle. And that's enough for the obstacle to have to disappear and vanish. So whatever there is a problem in the meditation, don't try and beat anything up. Don't be aggressive. Don't feel guilty. That's just beating Mara up. All you do is, I know you, obstacle, and then it vanishes. So when you do get stuck in some type of meditation, please never use force, aggression. Don't try harder. Don't use negativity. Use your wisdom. Try and see what's going on. And usually it's not that hard when you look in the area, what do I want or what do I not want? Sometimes the people aren't patient enough. Impatience is another part of wanting. It's going well, but it's not going fast enough. How long do I have to stay in this present moment? I know I want to go into the deeper stuff, not this present moment stuff. I'm just wanting that bit more is what will stop you developing your meditation. There are two types of patience, which I discovered in my meditation. It's just one way of looking at things, but it opens up, so what is the problem, what's not the problem. What most people consider to be patience is waiting for something to happen. So, you know, you're meditating there, maybe present moment, maybe you're watching the breath, when is this limiter going to come up? Now, waiting for the limiter. You know, Ajahn Brahm says about this limiter, I'm still waiting for it after 6 years. Now that's waiting for something to happen, which is waiting in the future. It's as if you're not really being here, but your eyes are cast in the next few moments, waiting for a nimitta to come. Waiting in the future is not waiting at all. It is wanting. But sometimes it appears like you're waiting. The same as if you're waiting for the bus to come, or you're waiting for the aircraft to take off. How many times in life are we always waiting in the future, waiting for something to happen? Is that peaceful? It never is. which is why when we get very tense, we lose so many opportunities, as I said earlier in the retreat, the in-between moments of life. We've arrived at the airport, but it hasn't taken off yet. We're in between something. We have to learn how to be in the in-between moments of life and not send our mind forward to the future, to what we expect. We, instead of waiting in the future, we wait in the moment. Which means we're not looking at what's going to happen next. We're not expecting anything in the future. All our attention is squarely put on what's happening now. We're waiting on the moment rather than waiting in the future. I like the word waiting on the moment because in English that conjures up the idea of a waiter at a top restaurant. And a waiter at a top restaurant is always looking at the customers on the table, mindful and ready to take their plates away and put new plates on there with new food on the next course when necessary. They never wait in the future, they wait on the moment. So, that is one of the obstacles which we have in meditation. We're being here, but we're not really being here. We're waiting for something to happen in the future. That is not being patient. So any of you in your meditation said, when's it going to happen? I mean, watching the beautiful breath, there's still no nibbitas. That's the problem. There must be some wanting. And the wanting is waiting in the future, wanting something to happen, expecting it to happen. There's also just, you know, the wanting of, you know, wanting to be more peaceful. Now, wanting to be more peaceful, again, is one of the greatest, one of the big hindrances to meditation. Yes, you know, you're maybe just in the present moment, or you may be sleeping or restless. How do you overcome that restlessness or that sleepiness? If you want it to go, it won't go. Why? It's because that wanting is the hindrance. It causes the suffering. So instead, if you are tired and sleepy, I am happy to be tired. I am happy to be sleepy. I'm just so content being the sleepiest monk in the whole of Thailand. Now, if you are like that, you get so content and so peaceful, the cause of sleepiness, the cause of restlessness is just undermined. You just, the cause of sleepiness is you're tired. The cause of restlessness is you're not content to be here, so you always want to go somewhere else. Those are the causes. So you take the causes out, it's always wanting something causes the problem. So when we don't want anything, then you're totally at peace. I told the story a couple of days ago, which comes up again, about monks. And it's good to say this, you know, this time of the retreat, because in a couple of days' time we'll be leaving. And in a couple of days' time, people will always come up and say, oh, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, is there anything you need? People always like to show their gratitude by giving you material things. You don't need to do that to a monk. The best way to show gratitude is always to tell me just how peaceful you've been. And that's much more important to me than giving me more biscuits or more coffee or more tea or more fruit or more waffles or more whatever else you give me at lunchtime and breakfast time. And that's what really makes me happy. You don't have to give me personal things. And especially, you know, giving monks money. And that's against our rules. But, as I said a few days ago, there is a loophole. There is always loopholes in cheese in the afternoon. That's a loophole. People ask, well, you can't have milk, how can you have cheese? It's a loophole. So the particular loophole for money is that you can't give a monk any money. But you can say, and sometimes people do this in Thailand, they give you what they call Phaya Anumodana, which is a little sheet of paper, and on it they say, now I hereby give you 100 baht, and it's kept with, say, Auntie or somebody, or with Shirla Engchi. Now that is acceptable. And they say, whatever you need for 100 baht, just go and ask them thereby for you. Now, the first time that happened to me, it showed you just what craving does to you. This first time they told me that I helped some man, he said, I want to give you 100 baht, what do you want? When you don't want anything, you're so peaceful, you just can't think what you want. So I told him, well, come back tomorrow, when you come back, then I'll let you know what I need. And so he said, yes, so you've got to come back the next day, get me overnight to think what I needed for 100 baht. Now that's not that much these days, but this was about 35 years ago, so it was quite a large amount of money. And as I was in my room that night, I got out a piece of paper, and I think actually, quite accurately, it was the cover of a mosquito coil. You know, this little paper, because we didn't have much paper there. So I wrote, the first thing I needed was actually an exercise book, no things to write on. It really worked for months in those days. I needed an exercise book to write on. And I was writing with a pencil, and it was very hard to write with a pencil, so I asked for a biro pen. It's a simple one, the sort of things which you take for granted these days. So that was number two on my list, the biro pen. And I was writing this by a candlelight. So the second thing was one of these little oil lamps which I can use. And while I'm at it, it was very difficult walking through the forests of Thailand with my flashlight, which was needed, batteries. It was so dark. So I put batteries down next. And then when I was thinking of walking, actually my sandals were wearing out, you know, they're all patched together, so the third, next thing down was a pair of sandals. And then already I knew that 100 baht was not enough. And that's when it got very difficult, because I couldn't cross any one of those things off the list. Once I thought about them, I wondered how I had ever survived without them. They were now necessary. And I kept on going, and soon I couldn't take anything else off the list, but I kept adding more things on the list. And it was impossible to take things off. And soon 1,000 baht was not enough, until I realized what was going on. So I literally screwed up that piece of paper and I threw it in the spittoon. When that man came the next day, I said, never ever do that to me again. You can do whatever you like with 100 baht, you can just burn it in a rubbish bin or whatever, I don't care, but don't give it to me and don't ever do that ever again. I was such a happy monk before he gave the opportunity to crave. And I realized just what was going on there. Just being content gave me so much peace and happiness. As soon as I wanted something, it was never enough. Never enough. That's the trouble. So here in meditation, how much is enough in meditation? The trouble, isn't it? You get sort of the beautiful breath, it's wonderful. But then you want nimittas, it's not quite enough. You get nimittas, it's beautiful, like, no, I want first jhana. You get first jhana, it's still not enough. You want second jhana. Second jhana, it's still not enough. You want fourth jhana. Fourth jhana is not enough. You want the immaterials. Immaterials is not enough. You want to become a stream winner. When you're a stream winner, it's still not enough. You're still not satisfied. You want to become an arahant. When you're an arahant, it's still not enough. You want to have all the psychic powers. People are so hard to satisfy. So instead of that is the wrong path. That type of person who was a Tibetan monk many years ago, he was a drunkard and killed himself, but every now and again he said some wise things. It just shows you that sometimes you get some wise teachings from people who are really stupid. But I don't care where they come from, if they're wise teachings, great. And he coined this term, spiritual materialism. And just like we have materialism in our world, you know, who's got the biggest salary, who's got the biggest house, who's got the best car and the designer clothes. We also have spiritual materialism. Well, after the retreat you go to your friend and say, what jhana did you get? Oh, I only got nimittas. Only nimittas? I got nimittas years ago. I'm on second jhana now. You're on second jhana? Come on. How long have you been doing this? I'm on fourth jhana. Fourth jhana? Come on. I'm a stream winner. Have you got stream winning yet? You're hopeless. And you can understand what you mean by that spiritual materialism. And that exists in our world as well. And that's one of the reasons also why monks don't buy into that. We don't tell you our attainments. Just to sort of downplay them so it's not spiritual materialism at all. We don't flaunt our attainments to the point that you don't know what we've got and what we haven't got. Now that's the opposite of spiritual materialism. You can see that happens inside of you. Whatever you are in the meditation, you always want something more. And that really surprises me sometimes. Sometimes people have this wonderful liminal experience, really happy, very joyful. They ask me, what should I do next? Oh, come on, isn't that enough for you? Having a beautiful day, we took this thing out for a couple of hours. Are you satisfied yet? No, I want more. That's the reason why you're going to get anything else. The people who really get deep meditation, they're the ones that have only got present moment awareness. Been here since the beginning of this retreat. I've only got present moment awareness, but I'm happy with that, that's good enough for me, I'm only a beginner. Those sorts of people, yeah, you're going to get enlightened pretty quickly. You have this beautiful contentment. This is good enough for me. So no matter what you're doing, the very fact you can sit in meditation and fall asleep, this is good enough for me. Or you can sit there just for half an hour, and just think of all these sorts of things. Yeah, that's good enough. Who do you think you are? Do you really think you're going to become enlightened? You're only a girl. Of course, girls can get enlightened, men can come and get enlightened, but a lot of times, when we want so much, that's what causes us the blockage. We never get anywhere. So contentment is the path. Literally it is happy to be here. And this is one of the stories which I developed to show what we really mean, what letting go is, a skillful means which helps you let go. And it's a story of the prison in Perth. I have been teaching a long time in prison, and now part of being a good manager is give all those jobs to somebody else. Sooner or later I'm going to give visiting Singapore to another monk, so I can just relax in my cave and do nothing else. That's a good manager. A good manager always delegates. And when they delegate to this monk or that monk so they can have an easy time in the future. So that's me. When I get to another 5 years or 10 years, I'm going to take it easier. I'm going to send all my other enlightened monks to come to Singapore or to Phuket, they can teach the retreats. Isn't that a good idea? Are you attached? But anyhow, when I gave up the job of teaching in prisons to one of the monks, it was a new prison, and people being people, the prisoners after a while in this meditation group, they asked him to stay behind a little bit longer. And so he did, and they gave him some cheese and chocolate and a cup of tea, and they wanted to chat with him. You know, like sometimes even me, just want to chat, not about Buddhism, not about meditation, just have a chat to see, you know, what's going on, to have friendship and fellowship. So they started talking, and the question came up, a common question in Australia where people have not much understanding of Buddhism: what do you do in your monastery? What is your average day like in Bodhinyana Monastery, a Buddhist monastery in Australia? So he started reciting the schedule. He started with, well, we usually get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And at those words, these prisoners inside the top security jail were really surprised. 4 o'clock in the morning, they said. Even murderers don't have to get up that time. And so the monk had to give the qualification. He said, well, it is optional getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, because you can always get up earlier if you want to, but not later. That's the only option. I said, well, what can you do afterwards? Now, can you watch the, you know, the late night movie? He said, no, we don't have TVs in monasteries, we meditate in the morning. And they sort of looked at each other and said, yeah, okay, I expect so, that's what you're supposed to do, meditate. But then what do you have for breakfast? Now some of you have visited my monastery in Perth. I don't get breakfast like I get here, you know, with buffets, with everything you possibly could want. And even things you don't want, which people still give you. Over there you just get like a cup and you can put some cereal in. I usually get a little cup of porridge and that's it. Oh, and a cup of tea as well. And I said, wow. Now in prison, these are Australian prisons, you can get whatever you like, a bigger buffet than you get here. You know, bacon and eggs and pancakes and fruit and whatever you want, you can get there for breakfast. So all you get, all they give you, and then what do you do afterwards? And afterwards, the monks of Bodhidharma Monastery, we work. And even I work. Many of you have been there and seen me clambering on roofs, mixing concrete. I also get involved in working. It's actually what keeps me fit. And I insist on doing physical work with the rest of the monks. It's also, and it keeps me down to earth. You know, instead of always sitting up here above you guys, I'm right down there messing around with all the other monks. And also, I love doing that. You know, I've got some sort of attachment to concrete trucks. I'm not quite sure what it is. But I think it's just like boys being boys. You know, they like getting in there, getting dirty, and getting cement all over them. And that reminded me of this story that, you know, once I was just finishing mixing some concrete for one of the buildings over there, mixing it by whatever, a little cement mixer. And I was right in there, shoveling the cement in and sort of emptying it out, wheelbarrowing it to the side, and really getting dirty, really getting into it, really good fun, messing around with your friends, mixing concrete and laying it. When it was all finished, I mean, I really looked a mess. Now, I'm not the most neatly dressed person anyway, but now I took it to new levels. You know, and just there was blocks of cement all over me, just really grey and dirty. And I was going to take a shower, but on the way I passed this Sri Lankan lady, who she must have been very high class because she was dressed in a very immaculate sari and so many bangles. You've probably seen high class Sri Lankan ladies. So many bangles on her wrist that literally it sounded like an ice cream truck coming in the street. Dingle, dangle, dingle. That's what she's done. You know, all makeup and everything else. And then I just happened to pass her and she said, oh, I'm looking for Ajahn Brahm. Do you know where Ajahn Brahm is? Now, I might be messy, but I'm still very sharp. So I told her, madam, if you go down to the dining room, he'll probably be there in a few minutes. Oh, thank you, she said. And I quickly went into the showers, had a quick shower, changed my robe, nice and clean. And I went down and talked to her for about half an hour. And then she was really impressed. And, oh, that's wonderful. You're a really good, wise, kind monk. And your monastery is very beautiful, except for one thing, she said. I'll always remember this. She said, as I was coming here, I met one of your monks, and he was very badly dressed and dirty. And that's really inappropriate to have such a dirty, sloppy monk in your monastery. And I said, madam, I understand. I will talk to that monk later. And I wasn't lying, because I did talk to myself. She didn't realize it was me. You know, because when you're really sloppy, you get those sort of ideas, and when you still put your robes on and tidy up, you look a different person. That's really, really funny. But it showed actually how hard we work. And now, even especially like people like Dania, she's the caretaker at Jhana Grove Meditation Center. She's always taking photographs of me, putting it on the internet, because people don't believe it. They don't believe that, you know, a famous monk could get dirty and just get up there and fix roofs and paint and stuff like that. But no, I'll always do that, because otherwise, you know, I do that just to come down to earth, because sometimes you're given so much accolades and treated like a prince sometimes, or treated like a celebrity. And the best thing for a celebrity is to get down there and just get your hands dirty and get a few cuts on your hand, fixing sort of loose. That really sort of makes you sort of, you know, one of the boys, instead of just some special celebrity. But anyway, that we work really hard. Now, when prisoners in Australia heard that, they really said, wow, they would never get us to work that hard. They take it easy over there. So they were surprised how hard we work physically. And then lunch. They said, lunch, again, not like here. In my monastery, the same as in most places in the forest monasteries in Thailand, everything gets eaten in one bowl. You get a big bowl, and everything gets put inside of it. Everything. So you have the rice, or the potatoes, the curries, and the sweets go on top. So have you ever had spaghetti with custard on top? I have. Have you ever had curry with ice cream? If you haven't, try it at lunchtime today. I believe there's ice cream on offer. So get your curry and put a dollop of ice cream on as well. And then you know what it's like to be a monk. You haven't lived until you've had curry and chocolate ice cream. Are you upset about that? Could you do that? Why not? You don't know how it tastes, do you? You just assume it tastes disgusting. It's just assumptions, that's all. You don't know the truth. Ahi Pasiko, come and see it. Pasikone where did it go when you eat it? To be known every wise person by themselves. So try it today and you'll find out what I discovered. It is actually very disgusting. Well, that's where we get up to. That happened even recently. I forget what I put. It was actually ice cream on the pizza. Terrible. Strawberry ice cream or pizza. Oh, yuck. But anyway, just for fun. So that's what we eat. And they said, oh, that's terrible. Because in prisons, even they said in solitary confinement, when you're naughty, they give you a tray in different compartments. So they do actually separate things out. But not in our monk's bowls. It all gets mixed up. And they said, what do you do after lunch? And they said, well, meditating. They said, can't you play sport? Can you play soccer or table tennis? Because I saw a few people playing table tennis. When I go back from here or from the cafe to my room, you pass the spire, there's a big table tennis place over there. And there's no way that as a Buddhist you could play table tennis, seriously. You know, I've got so much compassion and kindness to people. I'd always hit it as high as possible so that people have the best opportunity of hitting it back. I never smash it. Because that makes it too difficult for the other person. As monks, we're just too kind and compassionate. That's why I told people that there's no way we could ever start a Buddhist soccer team. Now please, the BF, don't start a Buddhist soccer team for the youth, because if you did start a Buddhist soccer team, it would have to be played according to Buddhist principles. Letting go. How many times have I told you to let go? Don't be attached to the ball. If the other team wants it, give it to them. It's called letting go. And if the other team can't score a goal, you score one for them. Own goal. Makes them happy. It's compassion. So Buddhist other teams always lose. That's why Thailand never does very well in World Cup soccer. So does Singapore. There's too many Buddhists in there. They always let it go. So no, we don't play sport now, but more meditation, maybe study. Oh gee, I think that's the time the actual prisoner said, don't you get fed up with meditating? And the monk was honest, he said, yes, sometimes we do. Well, what time do you have dinner? Because remember, these were Australians, they never knew about what Buddhist monks get up to. So we don't have dinner in the evening. The lunch is our last meal. Wow, that's terrible. So what do you do in the evening? I said, don't tell us. More meditation, you know, jeez. What time do you go to bed? And many of you have been to see where I live. I don't have a bed. I sleep on the floor. I said, the prisoners were just so surprised that everybody, now even serial rapists, they all have beds. No one sleeps on the floor in prison. And actually, at the end of that little discussion, the prisoners were so surprised at how austere a Buddhist monastery in Australia was compared to a prison. It's far tougher physically in a monastery than any prison in Australia. But I'd never be afraid of being convicted of some crime I never did, because if I go to prison I'd have a wonderful time. 3 meals a day, a nice bed to sleep on, nothing to do all day, to watch TV, do all sorts of stuff. So for me, going to prison would be like holiday. And if ever I wanted to do a retreat when I was in prison, do you know, punch one of the guards, you get 3 months solitary retreat. It's brilliant. Anyway, back to being serious again. One of the prisoners, they were listening to this, and a lot of writers of sparks in jail. One of them, they were listening intently to their friends saying how difficult it was physically in a monastery. And they had compassion and sympathy for their friend. So one of them actually, they said, classic line, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" He was invited to stay in prison out of compassion for the monastery. And of course that went around the monastery, we all had a big laugh. But then I sometimes contemplate these things, but wow, this is really strange, it's true. Why is it there's this huge waiting list of people trying to join my monastery? Even you guys, you know, trying to get into a monastery through retreat. It's almost impossible to get into. And you get into it, but it's very difficult. Why do so many people want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and just have these 2 meals a day and they work hard and have hardly any physical comforts? Why is there such a big waiting list of coming to a Buddhist monastery and a big waiting list of people trying to escape from jail? What's the difference between prison and freedom? It became very clear to me, and this was a wonderful insight. A prison is any place you just don't want to be. It doesn't matter where it happens to be. I was once in this, I think it was a 6-star hotel in Japan. There was this big Buddhist conference, and because I was the leader of the Australian delegation, they gave this incredible room in this Japanese hotel. It was supposed to be 6 stars. And I was sitting in there, couldn't turn on the TV, couldn't use the jacuzzi, couldn't use a mini bar, couldn't do anything. And for a few moments I really started getting upset. I looked outside and there was a beautiful garden, but I wasn't allowed to go outside, I had to wait for somebody or other. And I realised I didn't want to be in there. I want to be outside, or I want to be back in my monastery, in my cave, and just be able to walk around instead of being cooped up in this big hotel room. And I realised I was now staying in prison. A 6-star hotel room prison. Because I didn't want to be there. As soon as I saw it, I said, "Stop it, Ajahn, you want to be here." As soon as I wanted to be there, I was free again. So I realised any place you don't want to be, you've just made a prison. If you want to be here, you're free. It doesn't matter what it is, where you're at, if you want to be here, you're free. Freedom is the freedom from desire, the freedom from wanting to go anywhere else. Just happy to be here, content to be here. And the amazing thing is, you can be content anywhere. Even in a monastery, eating strawberry ice cream on pizza. If you're happy to be here, then you're free. Now that opened up a huge area of wisdom in meditation. In your meditation, how often are you happy to be here, wherever that happens to be? And how many times are you trying to get deeper? Now you should understand why you don't get deeper. If in your meditation you remember that story, which is why I told it at length, why I keep repeating it, if during your meditation you're happy to be here, you never feel in prison. You only feel free. And that freedom leads to deep meditation. So if you are aching, just be happy to be here. If you are tired, be happy to be tired. If you are restless, be happy to be restless. If you're just being able just to watch another breath, that's good enough for you. Be content. Just be happy to be here, wherever this happens to be. And then you find you have peace. And that peace is stillness. Let the nibbitas come all by themselves. Simply because you put in the right courses of letting things be. I don't know how many of you have had experiences in your life. There are times maybe in your life you've got a free afternoon. You're just happy to be here. You may be even in this retreat. This morning, this afternoon. You just don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world except just right here, right now. All those jobs and tasks you have in the future, I just forget about those. I'm just going to enjoy this moment. I'm going to enjoy this hour. I'm just not going to think about the future and all this stuff which I'll have to do later. I'm going to be happy to be here right now. And you feel this beautiful sense of contentment. Great thing is that contentment doesn't stay like that. It builds and builds and builds and gets super content and mega content and giga content. It gets more and more content. It builds. That's where you get the deep meditation from. So that is one of the four ways of letting go taught by the Buddha in his first sermon, the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. Freedom. Being happy to be here. Wherever that happens to be. So whenever I get stuck in my meditation, okay, I'm really happy to be stuck. This is good enough for me. Ajahn Brahm, the great meditator, I'm just going to be happy just to be able to watch one breath. Down as I forget about that. But I'm happy just to be with one breath. It just becomes delightful breath very quickly. Okay, it's very nice. I'm just happy to be with a delightful breath. Just happy to be here. And the next image comes into my room, which is Nimitus. I don't even want jhana. I'm just so happy to have a beautiful Nimitus. Just delightful. What more do you want in life than just to be with this gorgeous light? And when I'm like that, then jhanas, they just come. Because I'm happy to be here. Which means I don't go anywhere else. I'm still. I'm happy. And then you have all the ingredients for jhanas and beyond. So ask yourself in your meditation from time to time, am I happy to be here? Or have I just made a prison because I want to be somewhere else? You want to be somewhere else, you've blocked the path of meditation. Even if you want to be in good places, you're still blocking. So to overcome those hindrances, I'm just happy to be here. That this is good enough for me. And that's a beautiful way of meditating. Another similar way of meditating, we already mentioned that meditating is a huge act of merit. But one of the reasons is because it's a way of giving. It's one of the other four ways of letting go through by the Buddha. Chaga, giving, generosity. We did mention earlier that is it really generosity if you give a donation expecting acknowledgement? If you want sort of the nun's monastery to be named after you, the Jim Len Chu Hall for the Bhikkhus, or the Lathanjis, you know. And if she gives a big donation for that, it's not a donation anymore. You're getting something out of it for yourself. It is just another business deal. And that's why if ever you come to the forest monasteries, especially the monasteries, you know, which I look after, you will never ever see a list of donors. We will not acknowledge you. The reason is because we don't want to destroy your generosity. People give a donation, I know who they are, but no one else does. Simply because it's not generous if you're just buying advertising rights for your family or for your name. That's what it is when you put a plaque on. Dear Yupa Dining Room. That's not generosity, is it? Sometimes it's, look, it's me, I gave this great donation, yeah. That's not really what generosity is. It's generosity expecting nothing back in return. That's called letting go. So you'll give your body and mind to meditation, expecting nothing back in return. How many of you come to this retreat expecting to get something from it? If you did, you'd only get frustration and disappointment. But if you come here expecting nothing, you just want to give this time to meditation, which is your gift to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, as a way of making merit for your parents or whatever, your deceased. I'm just going to meditate just for this. My act of giving. I don't want anything back myself. Then you find it works. If you give expecting something back, it's not letting go. So that way, that's what I often do. I meditate, and I'm not going to try and get anything from this meditation. It's my opportunity, especially in the morning or in the evening, for me just to sit here. Just sit here just to give you inspiration, that's all. I don't want anything back for myself. That real giving, the real letting go, that is what takes you into these deep meditations. So there you see some really skillful means for overcoming the problems in your meditation. Ask yourself if there is a blockage, what do I want? When you find out, stop it. Ask yourself, am I happy to be here? Or do I want to be somewhere else? In good places. If you want to be somewhere else, there's no way you can be peaceful. So you change your attitude. Oh, this is good enough for me. I'm just going to be happy to be here. And then you get very, very deep. And lastly, you just give, expecting nothing back in return. You're giving this hour to meditation, and for once, you're not doing something to get something. You're not working to get a check. You're not sort of working hard for the benefit of all sentient beings. You're doing it for no reason at all, just for the sake of doing it. I'm just meditating just to meditate. Not trying to get anything out of it. Not trying to get jar, not trying to get light, not trying to get peace, not trying to get rid of my defilements, doing nothing. Then your defilements disappear. Those are the ways of letting go. Skillful means. For those of you who've got great mindfulness and wisdom, realize that what you're really letting go of is this control and this drive inside. So imagine yourself driving a car and taking your hand off the steering wheel, your feet off the pedals. That's letting go. Letting go of the driver, the controller, this person inside who just wants to retain things. When that person disappears, then all the letting go happens. But see if you can do that. You'll come back again afterwards, unfortunately. But while you're meditating, just disappear. Take an hour off. Take an hour off your life so you don't have to be responsible at all and see what happens. Basically, taking an hour off from your suffering. You get so peaceful and so happy. And all those beautiful states of meditation, they come to you. When you want them, they never come. When you let go, you're happy to be here, just totally content, just giving your time to meditation, not expecting anything. Waiting in the moment, not waiting in the future, then it all comes together and then you understand how to meditate. Totally different than any other human activity. Not like going to work or going to study, where you work hard you get results. When you don't work hard, you don't do anything at all. When you let go of all of this, stop controlling, stop doing things. Then it happens. A great skill, a beauty, a miracle. Of meditation. Okay, I've been rambling on for a while. I don't want to get anything out of this, but I don't know if you did. But are there any questions from the floor, from the chairs, before I look at some questions in the box? Okay, I'll do a couple of box questions, or basket questions first of all. There's one that's over here. Here we go! And then in a couple of minutes, maybe 10 minutes, we'll have Todd away. Food for the heart. Hey? You haven't had lunch yet. What is food for the heart? Food for the heart. A love? Oh, yes. Oops. I don't know whether I should read this out. It says, food for the heart. A love letter for Ajahn Brahm. Should I read this out? Here we go. To our dearest, venerable Ajahn Brahm, I write this note with the please, if you write an answer, please write it in English, not in Mandarin. I can't read Japanese. But I'm a bit hard to understand. With the greatest love, respect, and concern for your health. I was very sad to see something on your plate this morning. Oops. And realize why you have a weight problem, which has not caused a health problem. I haven't got a weight problem. I actually found out what the problem is called anorexia. It's true, because And once I looked that up in a dictionary. You know what it says? The definition of anorexia is someone who looks in a mirror and they think they're fat. So that's me. Every time I look in a mirror, I think I'm fat. So that must be anorexia. So that's my progress. I need to eat more. No, I haven't got a weight problem. I am very healthy and very fit. It's amazing that sometimes I find out my peers, the other mutts, I haven't had a sort of a health problem in years. I had a case of a cold about a week ago, but that passed in 1 or 2 days. It never stopped me. I kept on teaching and doing my jobs. So I have got a very healthy constitution. So for other people I know, other monks my age, they're always going to see the doctor for this or for that, a liver problem, gout problem, this problem. But my peers are probably the healthiest of the monks. For your disciples like me want you to be around for many years to come. I am round already. You want to be around monks for many years ago. I hope you all eat healthily. I hope you can put the same energetic power of letting go you have in the... It's good I can't read this carefully. It's difficult. I think, so I hope you can put the same effort into unhealthy food rather than unhealthy food you like to eat. But I have no doubt you could do it, you put your mind to it. Not my mind, I'm out of control, I let go. I'm just happy to be here. I would like to see a challenge to you to lose 20 pounds in 1 year. I have lost many pounds. Look at how much baggage I have. I lose a lot of pounds. If you could lighten your baggage and only come to the next retreat with as little baggage as I have got, instead of your heavy suitcases, if you lose a few pounds in your baggage, then maybe. I hope you will pick up this whatever it is, and accept the challenge. With method. I don't accept challenge, I just let go. That's one of the problems in being a monk. Being a monk, you have so many mothers. You know, guys, it's like having a mother. Come on, make sure you wear clean underpants. Make sure your robe is clean. Make sure you wash behind the ears. It was so wonderful being a monk, you didn't have that. So yeah, I'm well in control of my health. What kind of meditation do you think Ajahn Chah practiced during his last days when bedridden? Oh, now, of course, when he was bedridden, he was also unable to speak because of a stroke, so he could never talk back. So how do we know what type of meditation he was doing? By the results. In that story, I'm sure you've heard it before, it's a very brilliant story, many, many times. When Ajahn Chah, after his stroke, when he couldn't speak, many times he stopped breathing. With a long period of time, half an hour, a couple of hours. And I got this story from a friend. It happened one evening that Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. Now, at all times there was a medic, not a full doctor, but no, a well-trained nurse on duty, and usually with 1, 2, or 3 monks, you know, attending on Ajahn Chah, helping out. And so the monk saw this, the medic on duty said, I'd better get him breathing again, otherwise he'll die. And the monk said, leave him alone, he does this regularly, that's just a sign of deep meditation. And the medic didn't believe it. The monks argued with him, and the medic said, I know Ajahn Chah is going to die one day, but I don't want Ajahn Chah to die on my ship. You can understand why. So he insisted on doing something. So eventually they came to a compromise. And the compromise was the medic would take blood samples every few minutes to make sure the blood is well oxygenated. As long as there's oxygen in the blood going to the brain, there's no danger at all. And that was actually the compromise they had. And so for half an hour, 2 hours, I can't remember how long, Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing at all. they found out that his oxygen level was maintained at a reasonable level enough to supply oxygen to the brain if it needed it. And that was a wonderful thing to show that what Ajahn Chah was doing there, that could only be a false jhana or a bath. That's the only way where you stop breathing. But you know, there's medics, you know, who could actually see, yeah, you're not breathing at all. Then he'd come out of his meditation and go back to normal again. So that's one case out of many. People would get into deep meditation, you stop breathing. Perfectly safe, you don't die. So that's what he was doing. So that's actually how we know, many tales like that, we know what he was doing. What is the meaning of jhana? What is the difference between jhana and jhana? They rhyme. People with jhana get jhana. Supposing jhana. Now what jhana means, that is the wisdom, the deep knowledge, the deep seeing. It's like insight, if you like. So when one develops stillness, that's where one gets deep insights. Number one, I haven't really got into this, I was going to talk about this in a separate talk. Number one, when you have powerful mindfulness, only then do you realize that your mind has enough energy, enough oomph to really see the Dharma. And once you've had a few experiences of superpower mindfulness, you realize just all the mindfulness, you're wasting your time thinking and trying to work it out, you just got not enough computing power. You just got to boost up that power by superpower mindfulness and then start investigating things. And then you might just see these jhanas, these deep understandings of the nature of things. Otherwise you just can't see it. You're not bright enough. Which is why we keep stressing to get into jhanas, at least get into the limiters, really get the mind bright and energized and powerful. And then the jhanas will come. So the jhanas come from jhana. Jhana first, jhana next. That's the sort of the difference. So this jhana is deep place of stillness. Or as the Buddha said, samadhi pachaya yata bhutayana dasana. Jhana and dasana. From stillness, or stillness is the cause, samadhi, stillness, pachaya the cause. For yata bhuta, as they really are, jnana is wisdom and dasana, insight. From jnana and dasana, that comes from stillness, as taught by the Buddha. And especially that samadhi, the sama samadhi, the jhanas. From jhana you get jnana. I find myself inclined towards Buddhism. Yes, same with me. Hence this trip to the retreat. I am even more inclined to learn more about Buddhism and meditation after having to enjoy myself during this retreat. Does this inclination have anything to do with past life or karma? Thank you. Sometimes it does. Because certainly for myself and for many other people, when you first read when I first read my first book on Buddhism, it didn't convert me. I just realized I already was a Buddhist. I'd already had been a Buddhist. But I didn't really know about it because no one told me what Buddhism was. So I realized the first time I read a book on Buddhism, hey, that's me, that's who I am. It's like a discovery of, you know, your philosophy, inclinations and understanding of life. So for me, obviously it was from previous lives, you know, just rediscovering something I'd known deep inside my mind, but, you know, hadn't come out because I hadn't had it brought forward because the culture I'd grown up in, you know, couldn't even spell Buddhist. Well, sometimes they call it Buddhist. Actually, even our president this year keeps calling it Buddhism. Not Buddhism, not Buddhism. And I'm trying to much like voodoo. Buddhism. But anyhow, that's what happened to me. So if you're inclined towards it, it's quite likely it's because you're remembering something which you've known deep in your mind from previous times. You've been here, done it before. And it's a great recognition, a great sense of peace and happiness by coming home. I did say we'd have a toilet break. So let's have a toilet break now. And then afterwards, come back for a few more questions and then a meditation.